Good morning, diners and travelers and whiners.
whiners today, whiners. Yeah, we have all these programs about food. Why don't we have more programs about drink? Well, we're going to rectify the situation today.
Right, we're going to do whiners, not wieners.
let's have a thought for today. I can't remember whether this is Benjamin Franklin or Thomas Jefferson. But either one of them, both smart guys, said wine is a constant reminder that God loves us.
Exactly, yes.
And I think the other one said a day without wine is like a day without sunshine.
Right.
So
a day without on the menu is a day without sunshine, and that's what you're listening to, On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig.
And we cast far and wide to bring you an interesting program because we're starting out with the new owner of a landmark chateau in the Barossa Valley in Australia.
Yes.
Which was at the foundation of the wine industry there. We're going to Sicily, where Giacomo D'Alessandro's family owned a property for several centuries, but only decided to start making wine commercially about 6 years ago. Try about that one. And then an Austrian company, which is single-handedly or two-handedly in the hands of 11 generations of Riedels, taken over the American market for fine wine glasses. So quite a combination for the day. We hope you'll enjoy the program. Without further ado, let's go down under. It's very poetic, isn't it? Chateau Tanunda from Down Under.
Well, otherwise they can't get the pronunciation right.
Right. And John Gieber, who is the current proprietor of Chateau Tanunda, which has been in existence for, by Australian standards, a very long time, is with us today. He's actually talking to us not from Down Under, but from Chicago, where he's here visiting the United States, and I'm sure trying to dispose of some of his wine. John, welcome to On the Menu. Tell us the story of this real landmark property called Chateau Tanunda.
Well, thank you, Peter. Chateau Tanunda was part of the development of phylloxera epidemic through the world that wiped out all the vineyards in Europe, and there were three places in the world at that time that you could get grape, and that was Australia, South Africa. There was a real demand from the Victorian eras and epochs to get wine, and those three places were the only place in the world, America, Australia, and South Africa. And so what happened is wine was made in Australia, put into barrels, sent across to England to meet that demand. They were getting prices equivalent to a pound a gallon, which would probably translate into something like a dollar. For one litre, you'd get $200. And that really, Chateau Tanunda started the Barossa Valley wine industry. And at that stage, it was the biggest recession in Australia with banks going bankrupt. And the wine industry in South Australia certainly pulled it through. So Chateau Tanunda was the biggest building of its time, bigger than Parliament. It was the biggest winery in the Southern Hemisphere. Played a real cornerstone of the Barossa winemaking industry and the Australian winemaking industry.
Now, if we go back to the era of wine in Australia, wines were planted and vines were grown before that, right, by the South Australian immigrants from Germany, I think, in the early 19th century. So there was an era of winemaking, but not on the scale, perhaps, of Chateau Tanunda.
That's quite right. And the very first vines on the Barossa Valley were planted on our estate in 1845. So, yeah, we go back. Those early German immigrants came to South Australia in 1836. Very similar in a way to what happened in the Napa Valley, except they were Italian immigrants, and they brought this wine culture with them.
Right, so a business that is prosperous enough to build this huge building, you can't, if you're in the Barossa Valley, you can't miss it. Everybody gives you directions, turn right or left, or go straight ahead at Chateau Tanunda, because you can't miss it. But what happened then?
What happened was it was extremely prosperous and did very, very well, and Chateau Tanunda was making wine and brandy. Brandy was very much a drinker of that time, particularly going into the First World War. Chateau Tanunda brandy was the biggest brandy in Canada. It was also His Majesty the King's brandy served in all His Majesty's hospitals in the UK at the time. And so brandy was a big thing, and that really took off. Then in 1916, a ship going from Australia to Canada got torpedoed, and on that had an awful lot of Chateau Tanunda brandy. That caused huge financial difficulties. And the Sepals family, a very famous original family, winemaking family in Australia, bought Chateau Tanunda, and they used that. Sepals had been more of a port and sherry producer, and they bought Chateau Tanunda because that had the brandy and the red wine making. And that stayed in that family all the way through until about 1986, when Penfolds bought Seppelt's. In turn, that became corporatized and became South Corp. In turn, they left Chatterton under because it was more of a huge historical building. Nobody really knew how to handle it. And really, corporates aren't very good with historic buildings or indeed more traditional winemaking or commercial type things. That's their strength. And they then sort of abandoned it, and the Chateau was left for a bit of a ruin from the period 1993 till 1998. And for my sins, I was a guy who bought it, and we've resurrected it, and it's been extremely interesting life journey to be custodians of such a fantastic building.
Now, the interesting thing is that the Yolumba, the Hillsmiths of Yolumba, kept going throughout this period with a building that's really not unlike Chatterton, and perhaps not quite as big. And they're still going. We actually stayed on their estate. We stayed in the residence they call Percy's.
Oh, right.
And our last visit to Barossa.
It was wonderful.
Very privileged to stay there.
Oh, it was fabulous.
But I guess that one stayed in the same family and didn't go corporate.
Yeah, and that is one of the great proud private families of Australia. They've done very well, nothing other than high regard for Yolumba. We know the family quite well.
You've done some good things yourself now. What led you to the
moment
of madness where you bought this huge chateau in the Barossa Valley in 1998.
I mean, whatever possessed you.
Well, and, be careful of men in Lycra, they say, and I ride bicycles. And I saw this thing out of the corner of my eye. We were winemakers. We have other vineyards in New South Wales, Cowra Estate, which is the very first Chardonnay vineyard in Australia, as in one whole vineyard, and suppliers of Petaluma, Chardonnay grapes to Petaluma. So I wasn't overly familiar with Barossa. I knew a little bit about it, or quite a bit we used to buy, but I'd never seen this building hidden behind all these trees. And of course, nobody spoke about Chatterton under wines anymore. They would sort of run out, and there was Chatterton under brandy. I'm not a brandy drinker, so I didn't really focus on it at all. And I saw this building, and I thought, wow, this is something worth saving. This is something I could almost make a life work out of, and we have. And it's really interesting that in 1895, at the Empire Exhibition in London, Chatterton-under wines with a claret and another white, which was called a Constantia, they won the best wines of the Empire Exhibition. And last year, you know, the International Wine Spirits Competition is really the Olympic Games of wine in the world, northern and southern hemisphere, 7,000 vines, and we ended up winning the world's best Shiraz, and then our Grenache with Chatterton-under the Everest beat our the Grenache beat the Everest and all the other varietals and became the world's best single red.
So I think perhaps what you're suggesting maybe is that your adventure has been successful, and it's, you're to be congratulated on that. Now let's talk some more about the wines. As I understand it, you have wines at three distinctive price points.
Yep.
And we're going to talk to listeners around the world. Bear with us, because we'll be talking in U.S. dollar equivalents, because that's the easiest thing for us to do. So the range of wines that we sampled, which are called Grand Barossa, or is it Great Barossa?
Grand Barossa.
Grand Barossa.
Yeah.
And you have two reds and a white.
Yeah, we've got a Cabernet Sauvignon and a Shiraz and a Riesling. Quite unusual to be coming out with the Riesling from some very old vineyards in 1929. And they sell on the American shelves at about $18. And then we move up to another level called the Noble Baron, Chatterton under the Noble Baron, and there is a Cabernet Sauvignon and a Shiraz, single vineyard, very high quality wines, really stepping it up, and they sell for about $48. And then you shoot right to the top of the Rolls-Royce badge, and that's the 100-year-old vine Shiraz, which is from 120-year-old vineyards, a very small vineyard of 176 vines. And that sells in America at about $150 a bottle. And that actually, last year, James Halliday nominated that the number two Shiraz in the whole of Australia. So distinctive range, wines with character, wines made with open fermentation. We have only one word on our tasting bench, and that's called delicious. A wine is either delicious or not.
Oh, very clever.
There you go. That's a nice way of putting it. Now, our sampling experience, incidentally, we loved the Riesling. We thought the Riesling was just excellent. And I'll tell you a funny story, because there's this great argument around the world about this thing called terroir. What's terroir and what's not? And during our stay at Yolumba, Jane Ferrari, you may know Jane, I'm not sure.
I know Jane, yeah.
Jane, we got into conversation about this with Jane, who we interviewed on behalf of Yolumba. And we were going to dinner at, I think it's called the Vintner's Inn.
Yep.
Not too far away. And all of a sudden we set off down a dirt road, up to the top of a hill in Jane's pickup truck. And she stopped at the top of the hill, got out, set down the tailgate of her pickup truck, and put 6 wine glasses on it and started to open wine. And she pointed over in this direction, and she said, "This is a Riesling from over here," and I forget which it's called, "and this is a Riesling from over here, and they're different, and that's terroir." I said, "Jane, you didn't have to take me all that way to convince me of that. I was already on your side."
Yeah.
But the terroir comes through in your Riesling too. The reds we liked, but we thought the reds needed longer.
Okay.
Because I think we were drinking 09 vintage, and as befits all good wines, they should spend a little longer than they had getting ready for us to drink them.
The interesting thing with our wines is open fermented, basket pressed, and unfiltered. The wines have a genuine smoothness and elegance through them. The other thing is that we actually control a fair amount of the Cabernet Franc in the Barossa, and there isn't a lot of it. Mm-hmm. So in each of our wines, other than the 100-year-old, you're going to have a percentage of Cabernet Franc. Now, why do we do that? Because the wines of Barossa tend to be quite bold and forward.
Yeah, they do.
Generous is a better word. And how you make them, you can either take that to extremes like rock stars, or you can make those wines like our traditional wines of character out of Barossa. And you put a little bit of blending, something in there, like a Cabernet Franc, that just tones them down, softens the tannins, and actually create some very interesting berry lift in the fruit. That's what we try and do. So we make wines that you can drink, not that you have to eat. You make delicious wines, and that's all we're trying to prove. And softness is our creed. We are winemakers, not carpenters.
I like that.
We believe
in
that.
I like that a
lot. And that wine should be framed in oak rather than over-oaked. Mm-hmm. Very much like food, Anne. I mean, you deal with food all the time. And
right.
You know, you put a lot of salt on it, or you want to hide it, you put some sauce, and sauce has got sugar, and, you know, in the end, you know, what are you eating?
Mm-hmm.
Same in the wine world. What are you drinking? I mean, you can fiddle with a wine, and, you know, you can sort of fiddle too much, or you just let your wines do the talking. And the way you produce wines is really quite dramatic. If you do open vat fermentation, by and large, you are something like 1 to 1.5, 2% lower in alcohol, because those wines are interacting with the atmosphere, blowing off steam, interacting with oxygen. Now, wine, as you know, oxygen is both your friend and your enemy.
Right.
And we're making those sort of wines of character, wines of class, what I'd say Australian generosity with old world elegance. And they're fantastic. I've just come off the Wine Spectator tour. I was tasting a lot of the top-end French wines, and it was very, very apparent that they are making what I would call leaner wines, and very good, there's nothing wrong with them. And then you go to wines like ours, which are generous, with a great degree of elegance, but with that great Australian generous. And then you go to the new world, powerful Australian winemaking, which is like, you know, over-confectioned, and I don't particularly like it,
right.
But obviously there's some guys who do.
So, you're suggesting that that year did not need additional aging?
I think the Grand Barossas that you were drinking are fine. They will age okay. There's no problem. 10, 15 years is no problem at all.
Mm-hmm.
But the softness is what's carrying those wines. The Noble Barons do need a little bit of time, but there was a 206 Cabernet in there that's drinking beautifully. Really beautifully. I think that's a great wine.
Now, these are wines that are generally widely available in the U.S., John. I mean, you're here trying to work on that, I'm sure.
They are available, Peter. We're in 13 states, but you can get them anywhere. If you ask your local wine merchant or bottle shop, they will certainly be able to get them for you. You know, wine is about patience, and this is the overall theme in the Shadowton Underworld. Speed versus patience. We are on the side of patience. When you make wine, you know, our ferments might go for 10, 12 days for all I know, 14 days. In modern winemaking, they go 4.5, 5 days. We believe that reputations in wine take a long time to build, so they might take 10, 12 years before Shadowton Under claims its rightful spot as the iconic or one of the great iconic wines of Australia. Other guys, the more corporate guys, believe that wine is another fast-moving beverage, and we don't believe that. So in many ways, it becomes a game of patience versus speed. We linked with Banffy in America, and they are very much on the side of patience versus speed, or you can say patience versus greed. We are families that play on the patience side.
Great. Well, I'm so glad that we had the opportunity to catch up with you. It's a great story. It's a great place to visit. I understand if you get all the way to Shadowton Under, you can not only play croquet, you can also either play or watch cricket, which is another game for the patient.
Sure.
And so let's hear it for the Aussies and the next Ashes. Well, no, we want them to lose this time, I guess.
Yeah.
John, before you go, what is the situation with drought and climate and the Barossa at this point?
And it's such a pertinent question. Firstly, if we go all the way back, why was Barossa farmed and planted with grapes? Very few people know it is in a genuine valley. It's the same size as Napa, by and large. And there is underground water in the valley. However, as you go up onto those hills, and you were speaking about Yolumba and Pusey Vale, that sits on one of the biggest limestone quarries in the world. So the water table and the retention of water in limestone, as you know, is quite good. I mean, it stays there for a long while, and so the little roots can go down deep and drink on it. Australia is a land of extremes. We've had 5 years of unbelievable drought, caused havoc in the vines, really very, very dry conditions. Of my 186, 120-year-old vines, 9 died in that period,
oh,
after
no.
120 years. They just couldn't handle it. And this year, we went through the extreme again.
What the fuck?
Where we had so much water, we didn't know what to do with ourselves. We had, in one night in the Barossa, more water than in the previous 6 months, more than half the year's rainfall. So we are a land of extremes, always has been, always will be. You know, it's a vast continent the size of America, and yet there are only 20 million people living in it. So you go through these extremes, and of course this year, you prune your canopies in such a way that they act as an umbrella to protect the grapes, and we had, you know, almost no heat. We had a lot of rain. Poor old grapes under the canopy were battling. They ripened. We finished picking yesterday.
Oh, my goodness.
12th of May. We're talking 6.5 to 8 weeks later than when we normally finished harvest or finished our reds. So that's what climate does. And let's be humble, because if you ever want to learn that there are other things that you can't handle, just become a farmer and a grape grower in Australia. You know, you are subservient to the will of Mother Nature. I find that wonderful, absolutely wonderful.
Well, once again, John, thank you so much. And
you're making me homesick, too. I miss Australia.
You miss Australia.
Yeah, but the difference is you'll be back there soon, and we won't be back there till next year or the year after. But we'll try to come a-calling on Shadowton Under ourselves when we do that.
Thanks, Peter.
And don't go away, because we'll be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, as we promised, here we are about to venture forth to Sicily, talking to Giacomo D'Alessandro.
In the shadow of the temples of Agrigento. If you've ever been to this wonderful island, if you haven't, you better get there, because it's a pretty handsome-looking place.
It's not so far from our other Sicilian winemaker.
Not too far from Plumetta.
Exactly.
Nowhere's too far away from anywhere else in Sicily, for that matter. So
When are we going again?
Oh, I don't know. We'll have to wait to see that. Pick some grapes. If you pick some grapes this year, we'll have to go see if they made any wine out of them. Okay. How about that?
All right. So that's, let's hear it for Giacomo.
So that's the plan. Anyway, Giacomo D'Alessandro calling all the way from Sicily. Incidentally, I should have mentioned that John Gieber also called us all the way from Adelaide. Isn't telecommunications a wonderful thing?
Giacomo D'Alessandro, you are the founder and owner of a winery called D'Alessandro Winery, located near one of my favorite Sicily cities, is Agrigento, with your magnificent ruins. Your family owned that land since 1820, and yet you just opened the winery. Why is that?
I mean, like often happens from the Sicilian territory, I was born in Palermo in Sicily, but I left Sicily when I was young, about 8 years old. And since a while, so since 1820, my family is on a quite good piece of land in the country of Agrigento. And about 6 years ago, together with my partner, we're just looking to do something different, something that will be more close to the territory where we're coming from. And probably we chose the wine something that could be the tradition and the innovation of the Italian products, and in particular the Sicilian. So this was a big fighting because my partner is more, he has a 0.5% from Sardinia, and myself is 100% from Sicily, so the 100% part of Sicily is getting better from the other part of the islands of Sardinia. So I'm back in Sicily and took back some part of the property that we get it, and that is, and putting together, you know, the people working there on the territory.
But you live in Rome, no?
Yeah, the center business, the center business of all my business is Rome. This in particular for the location of the city. So you know very well where Agrigento is. It's a beautiful place, but there is no airport. And to arrive to the nearest airport, you have to drive at least 2.5 hours. So joining in Palermo to go to an international airport. Then you have to fly to Rome, and then after Rome you can join the U.S. or whenever it's in international market.
Right. We have been looking at coming to Sicily again. I have been having trouble finding good connections, starting from the United States, arriving in Italy in the morning, and then finding that from some of the airports we connect, there isn't a flight until late in the afternoon. So, yeah. I mean, I've been looking at that. I know what you're talking about there.
Yeah.
You know
how difficult it is. And as my company and the company we have created in terms of D'Alessandro Wines, and as we're joking very well with the D wine, because our initial of the wine on the label is the D.
Right.
I'm traveling quite often, and usually I'm just traveling for 4 days in Brazil, in Sao Paulo, and I have to be back, send things for China or U.S. or going to Switzerland or in Poland where we imported all our wine. And I'm used to follow together with all our guys working in the company, you know, the product abroad all over the world. And being Rome is very, very useful, especially also for the people that would like to meet us in Italy. Because, as you say, it's more simple joining and arriving in Rome. At least you have to land in Rome. Whenever you go to Piemonte, or if you go to Tuscany, it's not used to go in Sicily, you know, because it's quite far. At the end, you have to land in Roma. So you cannot miss the D'Alessandro wine. So
of course. Now, I did want to talk a little bit about the winemaking tradition in Sicily.
Yep.
Because until quite recently, Sicily produced a very large quantity of wine, but it also produced a very large quantity of bad wine. At least as we understand it, a lot of the wine was made from a very generous grape called Nero d'Avolo, which ripens beautifully and gives you lots and lots of very strong grape juice. But in the hands of winemakers, it was really put into large containers for bulk use rather than being a fine wine.
You are right. That has been a problem of Sicily. We probably get the most well-known grapes all over the world that is really the Nero d'Avola product. But probably we have used in a wrong way. That's a typical of our way to do business in Sicily, you know, not only on the wining business, but generally speaking, we have a very great potential in quality, and sometimes we're pushing on quantity, and that's it's probably wrong things. I mean, you can control the quality also with the quantity, but of course not going over a million of bottles, because for everything you're producing, when you're producing in quantity, oh, you are a very strict quality control, and it's really very difficult. Probably few company in the world could do that.
How did you learn about winemaking? I mean,
we have a very good winemakers inside the company. Tonino Guzzo, that is our enologist, and together with our agronomist, they know very well the way to do the wine. My advantage is that I'm not coming on the winemakers, or I'm not coming from a wine company. We learn about what the others people and another company have done in the past, and learn about the errors that probably have been done into the Sicilian market. Let's say we have quite a large territory on the wineries, but we are looking and use the same way and the same system that you use. I don't have to say that, but maybe we have to keep the excellence that the other market is doing. And I'm talking about the Chateau in France. Right. The Chateau in France are a piece of land that are around 2 to 5 hectares maximum. And that's what we have done in Sicily. We have kept several different pieces of land between 2 to 5, so divided the land to 2 to 5 hectares, and there we have a constant quality control on the vineyards. That means that Nero d'Avola, maybe that we can get in and having in our bottle the Nero d'Avola 100%, is coming by 3 or 4 different pieces of land. The mixer of this of this topology of Nero d'Avola, these are the same, but maybe we have a piece of land that is about sea level, another piece of land that is about 250 meters higher on the sea level, another piece that is more exposed to the wind and to the seaside, and this mix putting together make the quality of our wine.
Now, you were dedicated, though, to making a wine of top quality when you began, correct?
You
said that we are only going to make good wine. We are not going to make bulk wine. We are going to make good wine. And we're going to do some other things with our wine, too, which I'll come back to in just a second. But first up, that was what was going on. And the Planeta family recently has been doing the same thing. And the two fine ladies of Sicilian wine, Donna Fugata and
yep.
Maria Costanza, have also been doing the same thing, haven't they?
No, because they're starting to produce, when we're starting with this idea, because the other one is doing really the opposite. Now they are coming back, they understand it is not the volume make, a good wine and company, but it's the quality of the wine you're producing. Of course, the most important things is use a quality, but of course you have to do a reasonable price in the market. You can love your wine and you can put a wine of $100 a bottle, no problem. But then you have to sell the $100 bottles. The philosophy of D'Alessandro Wine has always been, and by the starting of the company, is to do traditional wine, means wine of the territory. We probably use the Syrah. That is the only wine that is not really coming from the Agrigento area, but is a Sicilian still of grapes. And putting that wine at a reasonable, accessible price. That's for one reason. I'm always drinking the wine, and my first philosophy has been also having a wine that I can drink everywhere, every day. So if I like a wine, I want to buy 6 bottles, and I want to share with my friends. If I have a wine of maybe 20 or 25 US dollars, just to give you an idea, it's a wine that is affordable for an everyday wine, maybe. But if I got in a wine is 100 bucks or 150, it's maybe one time a month, maybe. Maybe once every 3 months, I don't know.
You just mentioned a price in Europe, so and that 20 to 25 dollar euro range is where you're targeting the market.
No, I was just talking about 20-25 US dollars.
Oh, okay.
That's That's the price actually we're having into the U.S. market of the Nero d'Avola wine.
Now, if I were to buy the same wine in Italy, what would I pay in euros?
You can probably buy the same wine around 8 to 9 euro.
One thing I must say, we've talked a little bit about the grape, we've talked about the use of Syrah in blending, and also I think that you had one that was close to 100% Syrah. We tasted all three, we enjoyed them very much. We would characterize them just as you did, as being an excellent everyday wine, one wine that we would be happy to drink one day, and then we would open the same bottle or a bottle of a different formulation of Nero d'Avola and Syrah the next day. And that's exactly how we treated the samples that you sent. Now, one thing that is absolutely amazing is the design that lies behind the brand.
Yep.
So you've created a brand not only of excellent wine in the bottle, but also some beautiful graphics and even a fascinating little corner of the label which you can actually peel off without having to remove the whole label to remind yourself what it was you drank. Now, who did all this wonderful design work? Did you do that?
Listen, yeah, we have joining the graphic and the design and with a specific graphic and designer company here in Rome that is specialized on the wine labels. But the idea, it was really to come in a different way of what normally the Sicilian wine has been presented. You know, like all the Prince and Baroni and typical Castel in Sicily and something like that. I'm the Barone d'Alessandro anyway, but I don't want to explain that by the bottles. What we would like to present was something fresh, something colors, where the four colors on the bottle is the four colors of Sicily, because there's the green of the land, the red of the warmest, and the yellow of the sun, and the blue of the sea. That is the four major character color based in Sicily.
They're absolutely beautifully incorporated.
And it's very contemporary, as you say, fresh.
It's very contemporary, very young, something that have to come close to the young generation. I mean, my generation, I'm 45 years old, but I think that the people approaching the wine, and the other characteristic of our label is that it's very simple. I mean, it's four colors, so you remember immediately a color bottle. And the other main issue is that we have not putting any fantasy name on the label of the bottles. So the name of the wine is the name of the grapes. So you know what you are drinking. If you're drinking Nero d'Avola, you are drinking the D wine Nero d'Avola. It's not sometimes it's used in Italy to use fantasy name for the bottles and for the grapes and something like that. Then you have to explain that inside there is a Nero d'Avola. My understanding on the other side is that if a consumer is drinking a wine, they have to know what he's drinking. They have to enjoy the grapes that he's drinking. We have a big fighting against, you know, all these issues with all the marketing people. Oh, no, you have to create good fantasy name or something like that. And they say, why? If I go to another restaurant and I want to buy a Sicilian wine, I want to know what I'm drinking. I don't want to read only the back label. I want to see exactly what I'm drinking immediately right by the bottle. That was the idea to create the four colors, and that is what the idea to create the label so simple, I have to say.
Now let's, for our listeners who haven't experienced Sicilian wines before, these are old wines. These are not shrinking violets of wines. These are not subtle wines.
Yep.
They are bold, they're strong, they're powerful, they go with meat dishes from pork to lamb to beef.
Yep.
Do you pair with seafood at all? I could see you doing this with swordfish maybe?
Listen, with the seafood it could be joining together, like say some tuna fish or something like that. Especially the Nero d'Avola, you're talking before about the blend. We get a blend of Nero d'Avola Syrah that is probably the strongest wine, powerful wine that we have. But when you're talking about the Nero d'Avola, you're talking about a 13 degrees product coming from the land of the sun. So you know how it's difficult to control, you know, the sun, again, to the grapes, and so to control also the volume of the wine. I think that the Nero d'Avola is a perfect wine that you can drinking with seafood, let's say a sea bass or really a tuna or something like that. So, I mean, a fish that have a strong or a little bit more cooked kind of fish, you know?
Yeah, or sauced calamari with the...
Calamari, yeah. So the tradition to drink the white wine only with fish, it's something that have to be going over. I mean... There are wine like this is in Sicily, like the Nero d'Avola, really not the one is going in a barrique, because one of the characteristics of our Nero d'Avola, you have to consider that we are still producing the Nero d'Avola like our old producer and my aunts and family is doing.
I think we get the drift of what's going on. I wanted to cover just a couple more things before we close. And one of them I've forgotten, so let me do the one I can remember first. On the Menu, of course, is a worldwide program, and you're producing in Sicily. Your wines are undoubtedly available extensively in Italy. What about markets around the world?
Actually, the market around the world is covering markets since November last year. We're joining an importer in the U.S. We are actually in 11 or 15, I don't remember, states at the moment.
Okay.
And starting next month to have our wine in Brazil, so all over the South American market.
Yeah, that's a good coup, because their economy is picking up like crazy.
Yeah, that is a great market for us, and it's not really a lot of Italians at the moment. There is quite a strong colony, as I say, of French wine, like it used to be. And, of course, the European market is one of our targets at the moment. We are very strong in Switzerland, in Poland, in Belgium, not yet in Germany. That is one of the major destinations, a major importer of the Sicilian wine.
Yeah, you got to get into China. That's the big explosion.
That's where we are going. That's where we are going, really. We had two beautiful Chinese guys 2 weeks ago in Sicily with us for 3 days, just to showing around the tradition and what our area could offer, you know, to the Chinese market. Of course, they don't have any kind of tradition in terms of wine, but as usual, the French market is always arrived before the Italians, and they had a good, there is a quite strong also presence of French wine. But with this importer, they are just importing Italian wines, like our import in the U.S., really, that is a vinifera import. And when you join a company that have only Italians, it's a good way to work, because they are very keen on the Italians. They know what the Italians, how to do marketing for the Italians wine.
Uh-huh.
I wanted to mention a couple of things before we get off the air that to me make Sicily really stand out from the rest of the world in a sense in the way that the wines are produced. I understand, this is from talking to Alessio Planetta, that sometimes you pick your grapes as early as July.
Yep.
And that you also, at least some of the time, pick at night, so that both the pickers and the grapes themselves are not stressed by the fact that it's extraordinarily hot during the day. Are you doing either of those things?
Yeah, we are not doing the night, but we're doing early in August, so let's say end of July, beginning of August. That is why we can maintain a freshness of the wine. Yeah. I mean, like the Nero d'Avola you tested. Especially also for the white wine. We have an Insolia wine that is 100% Insolia on a white wine that is about 12 degrees. It's very similar to a northern Italy white wine instead of a Sicilian, you know, very similar to the most famous Pinot Grigio. And everybody is very surprising, like in Sicily, you can do a 12 degrees very fresh wine. But that's it. Thanks to the fact that, and these are a strong operation, really, because you have to do. You have to go in the vineyards really at least at the end of July. So, and you have to do everything in a maximum 4 or 5 days. Mm-hmm. So it's a hard job, but in that hard job you can do a very great freshness and quite a wine.
And do you have olive trees too? You do an olive oil?
Not yet. It's one of the idea on the next step. The next step that we have is to create something very special on our territory. I mean, something like a top line of our red wine. We are still looking and working with the University of Palermo to find all grapes to put in Agrigento.
Yeah,
and
they program. I know that. Yeah,
it's very difficult because, you know, doing testing, it's not easy. But in the past, we had the Phylloxera, you know, that it's really destroyed the most part of the grapes on the southern part of Sicily. But the University of Palermo, they got some sample of that. And our agronomists at the moment are working on that project. And the wine and the olive oil is really the next step. We have a piece of land of about 11 hectares where we have 450 trees of olive oil. That is something that probably also the small market where we are actually, like Switzerland, for example, is asking to maybe having different kind of product. But that's it's a next project. I mean, at this stage, we have to consolidate our five wine product really in the market.
Making me very homesick for Sicily. Yeah, tell you.
Well, we want you to stay on there because we're going to do some private business planning on the menus next trip to Sicily, including a visit to D'Alessandro. But let's for our listeners, let's say this is a company to watch. This wine company, D'Alessandro, has come a long way in 6 years. In another 6 years, who knows where they will be? But certainly, they're a company to watch. And it's been a real pleasure to talk to you today.
Okay. Thanks, Peter.
So ciao. We look forward to meeting you in person.
Oh, yeah, I will.
And now another short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back, and now we're going to turn our attention to something just as important as the grapes and the winemaker. It's what you drink it out of.
Well, some people would have you believe that anyway, Doug.
Well, I mean, it was an amazing demo with the rep from Riedel the other day.
Yeah, Doug Cohn from Riedel is certainly a believer in that, but I suppose he would be. But we did test drive the glasses.
Yeah.
At the tasting that we referenced in the interview, and we found out that, in fact, Doug made some very cogent points with his different glasses, and we've been using our taster set of Riedel glasses ever since.
Right.
We're going to the fourth different type that we've used since we came home from the tasting with the Cabernet Sauvignon glasses tonight because we're having lamb chops.
Great.
I
think I was most startled to find out that you could take the same exact wine out of two different Riedel glasses and get a totally different taste.
Yeah, that was very interesting. Anyway.
And aroma. Yes, same different nose and everything.
Yeah, so listen to what Doug has to say, and we suggest you might even think about trying it out for yourselves. But regardless, there's a very interesting interview coming up.
Can you believe that our next guest just said, "I love the sound of breaking glass. It's how I feed my children." Doug Cohn, Northeast Manager for Riedel Crystal. Riedel in the United States. Welcome to On the Menu Radio.
Thank you.
We have a lot of things that make you happy because I've gone through entire sets of finished glass. I've gone through Cambridge glass, which is an heirloom.
Yeah.
The tinkle last night was from a competitor who's from a country close by you called Aisch. I think they're from Germany. And Riedel goes back quite a long way, and a country that Americans don't know a lot about.
Yes. Riedel Crystal actually goes back to 1756 as a family of glassmakers. They're currently in their 11th generation of family members, Maximilian Riedel, and his dad, George Riedel, 10th generation, work together today to continue moving the family business forward. Doing very well, I might add.
Now, did they start off making wine glasses, or did they start off making something else?
No, it was strictly any kind of glass product that would be requested for that particular period of time. It wasn't until the late 50s when Klaus Riedel, the ninth generation, decided to take a little bit of a sidetrack and focus on what he called at the time wine-friendly glassware.
Now, that's the
1950s. 1950s, yes. 1957, 58, he started to create glass that was specifically made for wine versus, you know, other beverages.
Now, off the top of your head, do you have any count of the number of different styles of glasses that Riedel made?
Top of my head, there's well over 150, I would say. I'd have to go through the book and tell you every single one today. But what the Riedels have tried to do is look beverages almost as individual children, whether it's wine or spirits or beer today, even through our other company, Spiegelau. But really trying to look at beverages as having their own message to speak of flavors and aromas and different components that would give the consumer a whole different experience instead of just trying to loop or group everything into wine, white wine, or scotch versus tequilas, this type of thing.
The sophisticated American wine drinker probably has in their collection, unless Riedel got a hold of their brains, probably has in their collection 5 or 6 different glasses, a routine white wine glass, possibly 2 reds, Burgundy and a Bordeaux style, if they're really sophisticated. They probably have sherry glasses, they have champagne glasses,
and
that's about it. Now, what's a reasonable number to have out of all the styles you make? I mean, you make well over 100.
Well, it's hard to say. It really goes into what people enjoy most for beverages. And in that case, you could single out particular glass. But even George would tell you that as much as we would love you to buy every one of his glasses, you don't need them. Particularly, it depends on your level of experience and enthusiasm as well. It's just how refined you want to get in the experience. We point out in a similar way, pretty much the glasses that you would describe, Cabernet, Merlot type of glass for most reds, unless it's Pinot Noir, which would require, in our opinion, its own glass. The whites, it sort of goes hand in hand today with mostly what wines are being sold in this particular market, the U.S., which would be a Cabernet Merlot style for reds and probably a Chardonnay style for whites. So those two certainly are in the mix. If you get into things like Sauvignon Blanc or Rieslings, we have a glass that is distinctly different from our Chardonnay, so it would represent a third glass in that sense. Champagne today is a bit of it's at a bit of a crossroads.
Yeah, because instead of the flutes now, people are recommending the coupe.
Yeah, the ones that are supposed to be the same shape as Madame de Pompadour's.
Well, we make beautiful flutes in different, slightly different designs for different price points and different standards of quality of champagne, but today the champagne producers even are looking at glass in terms of the grape instead of just a celebratory type of vessel like the flute would be, and more the icon. They're looking at the grape in terms of either Chardonnay or Pinot Noir, Pinot Meunier for standard champagnes, and trying to then say, well, maybe the flute doesn't quite deliver the message of our wines properly. So they've actually shifted to more standard wine glasses, either Pinot Noir or Chardonnay type of glass, to show most of the better champagnes out there today.
How interesting. Now, we're actually tasting with you later today, and I think you have a kit of 4 glasses. So would that kind of tasting kit, would that sort of conform with what you just said?
Yeah, absolutely. That kit will have, it's a good starter kit for us, good entry-level sort of thing. Glassware is actually our flagship series called Venom, which is a lead crystal bridal-specific or grape-specific glass, as we call them. And that represents the Cabernet Merlot, a Chardonnay, which is geared a little bit more toward a New World-style Chardonnay, a little bit more fruit-forward, a Pinot Noir glass, and the Sauvignon Blanc Riesling glass.
Now, let's take a step back. Let's think about what we want the wine glass to be doing. Mm-hmm. I mean, after all, that is what we're talking about. That's why you don't put it in a glass because it's about the same as drinking out of the bottle. You obviously are putting it in a container. And when you do that, it's going to breathe. It's going to give off odor. It's going to evaporate, in a sense, in a different kind of ways. It's going to open to oxygen in different kinds of ways.
Yes.
How do you approach the task of creating a bowl that's wine-specific like that?
Well, it starts with what goes into it. In the Riedel's opinion, the content commands the shape. So whatever the grape would be, let's stay with wine for now, whatever the grape would be, and whatever qualities or characteristics it brings to the table in terms of flavors and aromas that you would expect from that grape, then the glass has to then be shaped and sized and designed to deliver that message properly versus a different red or a different white wine that might go into it.
I have a question that's sort of related to this. If the grape and the wine dictates the shape of the glass,
yes.
I was astounded when last time we were in Australia to discover there's an entire series of Australian glasses from the U.S. glasses. Does that mean that if I'm in the U.S. and I buy Australian wine, I then have to buy the Australian wine glass?
No, no, not necessarily. What we're trying to do in any case where there may be a, Chardonnay, for example, there's a couple glasses as well, one that represents a little bit more of an old-style Chardonnay, old world rather, where there's a little bit of acidity up front versus fruit forwardness. And then I would compare against the new world-style Chardonnay glass that we have. There would try to balance out the fruit forwardness and bring forth a little bit of acidity just for that balance.
You don't think there's any hype involved with this, huh?
Well, I can tell you only, it's easy for me to sit here and say, no, absolutely not. It's a perfectly designed. What you need to do tonight and then maybe respond later is, does the glass make a difference? And when we go through the comparison tonight, I think you'll see, because we do use glasses to compare against that are not Riedel glasses. So they're sort of generic glasses from either the restaurant or wherever, usually a party rental type place, but also characteristic of modern day restaurants and hotels serving with these types of glasses. We'll compare wines of each of those varietals into these Joker glasses, we call them. But once I'm done with that, and once you see the difference in the wine as it's in a different shape or size glass, I'll go back and start tasting out of Riedel glasses with those wines as well. So here you'll have a very well-made, constructed, beautifully designed glass by Riedel, but it's going to be a glass that's holding the wrong wine. And you'll see the difference in the wine between those two or maybe three glasses, whatever we use.
Will we be blindfolded?
No.
Well, you know, I mean, there are people that actually, they've tested it, and people drinking wine blindfolded can't even tell if they're drinking red or white.
Absolutely. Well, we it's in our series, but we don't use it as often. We have a glass that's made out of a dark blue, almost looks black,
right,
colored glass. So when you put wine into a red or white, you really can't see the color, and you really then have to rely on your own senses of smell and taste to start to discern what those characteristics are.
Now, one of the most controversial glasses you introduced, I think, is the one that doesn't have a stem. I forget what they're called now.
It's our O series.
O series. And there, I mean, we've heard criticism of that because when you pick it up, you're actually imparting body heat to the glass. People with a fine style about things are suggesting that that's not a good thing. I suspect that one of the reasons that you made it is so that ham-fisted people like us who drop their wines by their stems and break them have a better chance of survival, I guess, of the investment that they've made in one of your glasses.
Well, it is. In a sense, it is. I have to say up front, it's really successful. It's been...
No, it's flying off the shelves. I have a friend who owns one of these wine supply gift shops.
They
couldn't keep them in stock.
It's held steady since it was introduced back in 2004, 2005. Maximilian Riedel, CEO of the company today, created that glass. And as the younger generation Riedel, he totally appreciated his grandfather and father's theories and designs and has never swayed from that. You'll notice all of our old glasses, the stemless, are the exact same bowl shape as our best Venom or
right.
Sommelier-style glasses as well. So he doesn't abandon any of the theory. But what he's done as a younger generation, he's looking at people who may be a little bit more on the go, maybe less time to stand and worry about a particular glass for wine versus beer or soda or whatever, and maybe not wanting to hand wash, and maybe if you're living in an apartment versus a beautiful home someplace, maybe shelf space is an issue for storage. So what he tried to do was just create a glass that was more convenient and a little bit easier on the pocketbook to people who are just starting to get into wine experience. So where they can get the value of a great varietal specific glass, non-lead, it's machine washable, it's stemless, definitely reduces breakage, easier storage, and it really then becomes kind of a utility glass almost for anything you want to pour into it. But if it's a varietal wine you want to taste, there is a proper glass for that. And what we try to do in terms of marketing, and Peter, your point about picking up and people complain about, getting the glasses dirty and warming the wine, this sort of thing. We look at it in terms of they apply to the quality of the wine. So these glasses are really geared to maybe the less sophisticated beverage versus fine wine. Now, when you think of it in that sense, some of the wines that are in the market today, let's say at a $12, $13 and under price point, there's some very good ones out there quality-wise, but they're not necessarily meant to be cellared or stored or temperature control isn't necessarily an issue with those as well. It's kind of a beverage that you're going to enjoy that day. Once it's opened, you don't have to worry so much that you finished it or didn't or how you store it after. It's a less sophisticated beverage or wine. Those glasses are perfect for that style of wine.
But, you know, I want to take you into another direction. And I actually have a question for you. And I don't think that I'm the only person this has happened to, which is why I thought it'd be appropriate to include it in this program. Riedel makes the most beautiful decanters.
Yes.
I mean, they're not they're wine glasses. I mean, they're absolute works of art. They're such wonderful flowing designs.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the ones I have is one we saw for the first time in Toledo in Spain. And it's shaped,
I think you
call it a different bird than I do.
A dove.
It's sort of like we call it a dove, and I think you probably call it something slightly different.
Yeah. You know which one I mean?
I'd have to see it. We have swans, we have...
I think it's a swan.
Okay,
it's an early model.
Yeah, I think you call it a swan and we call it a dove because it's not, to us it's a lower profile than that. But here's the problem. It's gotten really quite brown on the inside.
Okay.
And I actually tried to send an email to a generic Riedel email address that I found online and I didn't get a reply, so I figured, well, somebody from Riedel will show up one of these days and I'll be able to ask them.
Yeah.
What do I do about this? I mean, this is an expensive decanter. I don't want to go introducing a tool to the inside that's going to damage the glass by scraping it.
Sure.
But how can I get it clean? Mrs. Haig looks at it. It's on the sideboard in the dining room, and she says, put that one away. I hate to look at it because it's so dirty. what can I do?
Well, I assume it's one of the designs where you just can't get necessarily a sponge.
No, you really can't get inside it without the risk of breaking it, which I certainly don't want to do.
We saw a bottle brush in a Riedel display someplace.
It wasn't in a Riedel display, otherwise I would have known what the answer was. At least I don't think so. What would you suggest, Doug?
Yeah, first off, most of our decanters are lead crystal, and they're all handmade in that sense, so they're unique and one of a kind, and the designs represent sort of the creative side, the artistic side for the Riedels. But functionally, they all do the same. They're all aerating, they're all agitating wine, hopefully to enhance the aromas and the flavors at some point when you enjoy them. The trick with lead crystal in particular, lead is porous. Under a microscope, you'd notice that it has tiny holes and allows a certain amount of flow into the glass. Red wine has a tendency, of course, because of the color, to linger within a glass like that if you don't dilute it almost immediately after use. So you will get a little bit of, not staining so much, but maybe a tint of something that's lingering, and it could be the red wine that's oxidized and turned brownish for you. I'm not sure. But if you don't get water into it immediately and keep it diluted, the best thing to do is go back with hot water and white vinegar, which is sort of an acid bath almost, or a flush, that will go back through and start to clean out some of the pores and some of the inside surface of the decanter for you.
Okay, all right. So water and white vinegar, huh?
White vinegar. Hot water and white vinegar is a good one.
And hot water won't crack it?
No, they'll be fine. I mean, you know, not boiling so much, but out of the tap, hot water is fine with white vinegar. And we also sell a little packet of ball bearings, which is basically what they are, about 100 of them in a little capsule type thing. If you pour them into the decanter with water and give it a good shake or flush, they don't damage the inside, but they do pick up some of that sediment or something that may be lingering, and that'll help clean as well. And I'm sure there's other things on the market that are similar, but for our odd-shaped decanters where you really can't get something in there to reach it, that's a good method to do it, as well as the vinegar wash. A couple times a month would work.
We knew we'd get the right answer. We just had to get the answer in close enough.
We decided we're not going to stop making these gorgeous designs because they're hard to clean, but we have tried to figure out other ways to clean them for you.
You talk about porous. Now, do you think that what we were talking about with the breathable glass that Aish uses, is this a promising technology or not?
Well, I probably shouldn't go too far into it, but I can only tell you that the concept for Aish has been challenged, and in Europe it's been found to be not an effective method or design technique, I guess. So they've actually, in Europe at least, been told to not use that within their marketing materials anymore.
Oh, really?
I guess we better not say any more, huh?
Yeah, I mean, I that's something I can't speak to. I don't know enough about that end of the whole thing, but from what I've read even, just through literature within the trade magazines, that's the point about Aish at this point. We honestly don't look at it in any way other than, you know, we're very concerned with what we do with our glass and how that gets presented to the consumer. You know, these tasting events that we do, like tonight, is just the probably the best way for us to market our brand. We allow consumers to test drive our glasses, so to speak, and really find out if, in fact, they do work for them or not. And I guess the beauty of the wine experience, and I tell people at these tastings all the time, I'm not going to stand and argue with you that my glass is showing that wine better than the one you say is a better glass. That's the wine experience in a nutshell. And I would only say that we believe, truly believe, and I think our experience proves it, that the shape of a glass, the design of a glass, will make a difference in how you perceive the wine. If an individual likes one better than the other, there's no argument there. That's what wine's about. Enjoy it for what you enjoy of it. And I'm still going to toast and sit down and enjoy food with you as well. So,
well, Doug, you were very, very good. I mean, you're really good at your job. You know what you're talking about. You're very persuasive. I really look forward to this wonderful tasting tonight.
Oh, good. Me too.
Thank you.
I think you'll enjoy it. It might be an eye-opener now that we've presented the concept to you. It's always been the test drive.
Thank you. Thank you so much for joining us on the menu, Doug Cohen from Riedel's Crystal.
So there you have it, an on-the-menu program for another week. We hope you'll join us again, same time, same place next week. And until then,
bye-bye.